We want to protect them. For 12 years, even under Franklin Roosevelt, we went to Washington and we beat the drums to increase old age federal security. But in 12 years, we couldn't raise old age federal security even one red cent. They blocked it. We went into Ford and Chrysler and General Motors 4 or 5 years ago and we asked for a pension. And I can remember C.E. Wilson saying, "You shouldn't try to get old age security through collective bargaining. Why don't you go down to Washington and get Congress to pass a law raising old age security benefits?" We said, "That's a good idea." And we went to Washington again. And the halls of Congress were filled with full-time paid lobbyists being paid by Chrysler and General Motors to block our getting old age security in Washington. So we said, "Okay, if we can't get it down there where the worker pays part of the cost, we'll get it through collective bargaining and make the company pay all the cost." And that's the fight we started to make. Now, for 12 years, we made no progress. And the record is there to prove that. Within 24 hours after we nailed down the pension program in Ford, even though we know $100 is not enough, within 24 hours, the House of Representatives passed a law proposing to increase old age security by 70%. And what happened? Murray and Steele, President Murray, nailed down the non-contributory principle there. And overnight, these corporation executives who had fought against increasing old age security in Washington suddenly began to beat the drums. Who do you think's making the most noise for old age security now? Not Walter Reuther, although I'm making my share. Nobody other than that great champion of human rights, Mr. C.E. Wilson, President of General Motors Corporation. He's making speeches all over America saying we've got to increase old age security in Washington. Now why? I have said for years, you can get a pair of pliers, a big hefty pair, and you can get a pinch on the nerve that runs from the brain to the conscience of these great corporations. And you can pinch that nerve all you want, and they won't even blink an eye. But the minute you put a little pressure on the main nerve that runs from their brain to their pocketbook, they start dancing jigs. We didn't convert C.E. Wilson in the heart. That was conversion through the pocketbook. We said, if you won't do it in Washington where you pay only part of the cost, we'll make you do it through collective bargaining where you're going to pay all of it. And that's the thing that broke the logjam. Now, at the present time in Ford, the average Ford worker gets $30 from the government, $70 from the company, making $100. If we can increase the government payment to 50, then Ford pays 50 now, and that makes 100, but when we open the contract up, we'll lay another 25 or 30 on top, and we're going to build it brick by brick until we get it up there around $200 where it ought to be to give people security. We know 100 is not enough, but we've got to make a start. It's like the early vacation pay clauses. We started out with no vacation pay in our first contract. Then we got $10 and $20, and we kept raising it up. And that's the way we can build this. You give us 10 years. By working at the federal level and collective bargaining, we'll build it brick by brick to $200. The other thing that Chrysler isn't giving us, they are not giving us any money for a decent hospital medical program. I know something about Dr. Bills. A Chrysler worker and his family can scrape and skimp all their lives. And you can get a couple of dollars ahead and let one member of your family get into an accident or a long, serious illness, and it'll wipe out every penny you've saved all of your life. And I say if the Chrysler Corporation can spend millions and millions and millions keeping their machinery in good repair, they can spend a few million dollars to keep the workers and their kids in good health in the Chrysler plant. They say they will cooperate with the Chrysler workers. You pay for the hospital care and they'll cooperate. They won't even cooperate because they had a practical opportunity 2 weeks ago when the Blue Cross and the Blue Shield asked them to make arrangements for future checkoffs. But they said no because they wanted to squeeze and squeeze and squeeze the Chrysler workers and try to break the strike. We learned during the Ford strike and the GM strike that the number of workers who go into the hospital or the number of workers' wives who go into the hospital doubled during a strike. Why? It's understandable. The fellow figures, well, I've got time on my hand. This is the time to go and get an overhauling, a good repair job done in the hospital. Or he says, I'll take care of the kids. And the wife goes in. And it was just when the workers needed this hospital medical protection the most that the Chrysler Corporation tried to take it away from them. And I say we've been through some bitter battles with other corporations. But in all of my experience, and I've been in most of the tough ones, in all of my experience, I have never seen such bad faith, such complete lack of social responsibility, such complete defiance of the elementary factors of human decency as the Chrysler Corporation has demonstrated in that Blue Cross situation. And I said to Mr. Conder, you are buying yourself a lot of bitterness and ill will. And when the strike is over, it's going back into your plant on every machine because the workers know the dirty deal that you're giving them during this strike. Now let's look at some of the contract demands. I said we want a decent pension plan. We want a decent hospital medical plan. And we want some contract demands. Conder says, why the Chrysler contract is so perfect, we don't have to change it. And we said, even the Constitution of the United States, which is quite a perfect document, has to be changed once in a while. In a great factory, there are new problems that require new approaches and new contract provisions to solve. And yet the Chrysler Corporation is unwilling to make the kind of contract concessions that most other parts of this industry have already yielded on. In the Ford negotiations, although the Ford contract is far from being perfect, we made more than 50 improvements in the last contract negotiations. The Chrysler contract has not been changed for 5 years. Conner thinks you write the first one and you put it in cold storage. And you just look in once in a while to spray it with some anti-moth solution so the moths don't eat the contract up. But you never change it. Well, we want changes. Changes that we need. But when we made this arbitration proposal to arbitrate, to settle the pension thing, to settle the hospital medical thing, and to negotiate for 30 days, and at the end of the 30 days, arbitrate the unresolved issues, they said no. We said, what's the matter? Are you afraid to stand before a board of impartial judgment and defend your attitude? And Mr. Conder let the cat out of the bag. He said, collective bargaining has nothing to do with logic. It's got everything to do with force. The Chrysler Corporation is going to give only what it's forced to give. It's a matter of naked power. And that's why there's a strike on. It's your strength. It's the strength of 89,000 workers against the wealth and the arrogance of a great corporation. And that's why we've got a fight on our hands. It's the old historic struggle of the many against the few, of human rights against property rights, of people against profit. That's the basic struggle in this strike. What are we asking for? We're asking for union security. We have no union security in Chrysler, none whatever. They give us only what the law makes them give us. They have not yielded anything through the voluntary mechanisms of collective bargaining ever since 1937. We want to strengthen seniority to give the workers greater job security. Condor wants to take the guts out of seniority. We want to work out an answer to the 7-day temporary layoff problem, where you can lay you off out of line of seniority for 7 days and talk about it at the end of 7 days. We want it on the basis of seniority. We want to reduce the probationary period from 90 days to 30 days. Does it take a foreman in Chrysler 90 days to find out whether a guy can run a punch press or tighten a bolt? If it does, they'd better examine the heads of the Chrysler foreman if it takes them that long to find out whether a fella can do a simple production job. We want full contract protection for temporary probationary employees. We have learned through years of bitter experience the reason management wants to keep the probationary period long is they can ride that new worker, put the fear of God into him, say you're not covered with a contract, you haven't got seniority. And too many times, when they're trying to break the speed of the line somewhere, they put a young guy in there who's got a twinkle in his eye, who hasn't learned to score yet, and they say, look, you haven't got seniority, you're not protected by the contract, you better get in there and hit the ball. And then if they break the standard, they move that young guy over and put some old-timer on there and say, now you get the same production that young guy got. That's why they want long probationary periods. We want to cut it down because they don't need it. We want to change the promotion clause. Under the Chrysler contract, promotion hinges essentially on what's called merit and ability without consideration of seniority. Now, what does that mean? That's a holdover from the old Red Apple Club days, where if you polish the Red Apple for the boss, if you shine his car on Saturday and haul ashes for him over the weekend, why, you get the breaks under this kind of a clause. We want to eliminate the 2-year break in seniority. And we want to eliminate the 9 cents an hour differential between what the workers in Detroit get and what they get in the outlying plant. The Dodge boys will tell you, not too long back they moved, I think it was the wire harness job, out of the Dodge main plant. They moved it down to Newcastle, Indiana. And the guys down there doing the same job that was done in the Dodge plant for the same Chrysler management, excepting they're getting 9 cents an hour less for doing the same job. I know they can say to the Chrysler workers, the Dodge workers, if you don't hit the buck, get more production on this, we'll transfer this someplace else because we can get it done cheaper in the other areas. I say, if the workers in Newcastle could buy a Chrysler car for 9 cents an hour less, maybe you could justify differential. But when they buy a Chrysler car, they pay more for it than you pay in Detroit because they have to pay freight coverage from here to Newcastle. And when a worker in Newcastle walks in to buy a loaf of bread, the storekeeper doesn't say, oh, you're a Chrysler worker, aren't you? And he says, sure. And so the storekeeper says, well, we sell you everything 9 cents an hour less than the guys in Detroit pay for it. Oh, no. You pay just the same for the things you buy, but they pay the Chrysler workers in those plants 9 cents an hour less for the things they make. And we say that's wrong, and it stands as a constant threat to the job security of the workers in the Detroit area. We want to eliminate some of the wage inequities, rates all over the lot. We want to eliminate some of the merit spreads where that's possible, eliminate them completely, and cut them down in other cases. Some of the skilled jobs, some of the office workers, there are $100 a month difference in workers doing the same job. It's the old Red Apple Club again. If you polish the apple for the boss, you get the top of the spread, and if you don't, you stay at the bottom. Now, this is a hangover. In the early days before the Union, we used to have even merit spreads among sweepers. A right-handed sweeper got one rate, the left-handed sweeper got 10th of an hour less. That's a fact. On vacation. Now, we're reasonable on vacation. Someday we're going to get wise and we're going to ask for as much in vacation as K.C. Keller and Weckler and Condor get. But we're just reasonable now. We're asking for 6 months up to 3 years for $62, 3 years up to five, 124, and 5 years and over 186. Now that isn't very much, but that's a step in the right direction. We want to improve the grievance machinery, and there are many other demands. Now the question that every worker, every citizen of our community ought to ask: can the Chrysler Corporation afford the demands which the union has advanced? That's a reasonable question. That's a fair question. I say, measured our demands economic-wise, measured against the scandalous profits of the Chrysler Corporation, are a drop in the bucket. The Chrysler Corporation made 50% more profits in 49 than they made in 48. They made in 49 $213 million in profits before taxes. Now you pay wages, you pay vacation pay, you pay pension plans before you pay taxes. And the cost of our demands would come out of the $213 million. They made $132 million, or 34% return on their investment after taxes. Now, the Chrysler Corporation could have paid every worker in Chrysler 10 cents more per hour for every hour worked in 1949 and still have made a profit of 31% on their return on investment. You invest money in the corner bank, you get 2%, 2.5%. But they could have made 31% profit on their investment even after paying a 10 cents an hour wage increase. They could have paid 79 cents per hour and still have made 8% return on their investment. For every Chrysler worker, they made in 1949 over $2,000 in profit. And I say, if there's anything wrong with that, if there's anything wrong with the Chrysler workers' demands, it's not that we're asking for too much, it's we're asking for too little in this situation. Now let's look and see how the brass hats and the top executives in Chrysler are doing by themselves. These are the same gentlemen who sit in their ivory tower of security, of arrogance and defiance, and say no, no, no to the reasonable demands of 89,000 Chrysler workers, while they milk the corporation and the stockholders for fat salaries and bonuses. Take K.C. Keller. He made in 1948, $250,800. Mr. Hutchison, vice president, he made $225,800. Now, when the board of directors of the Chrysler Corporation got together, the chairman who was conducting the meeting said, "Gentlemen, Mr. Keller, Mr. Hutchison, these other executives, they've been loyal servants to the Chrysler Corporation. They've worked hard and long. They're getting up in years. And pretty soon they're going to be too old to work and too young to die. And look at poor K.T. Why, he only made a measly $250,000. Now, translated on an hourly rate basis, on the basis of 40 hours a week, 50 weeks in a year, Mr. Keller made $125 per hour. Mr. Hutchison, if you divide his salary up on a 40-hour week basis, 50 weeks in a year, he made a measly $112 an hour. So the chairman of the Chrysler board said, "Gentlemen, Casey and good old B.E. Hutchison here, they've been skimping and scraping and saving, but they have been unable to lay aside anything for their old age out of a measly $125 an hour, so we've got to do something about this." And so they made a motion in the Chrysler Board of Directors to give Mr. Keller, who makes $125 an hour, a pension of $25,200 a year when he's too old to work and too young to die. Now they even went further than General Motors. T.E. Wilson only gets $25,000. Mr. Keller gets $25,200. The $200 is for tips. Now I say there's something wrong in America, and we're fighting to change that. There's something wrong when a great corporation earning scandalous profits can give a $125 an hour executive a pension of more than $25,000 and then say to a fellow who works on the line or sweeps the shop getting a dollar and a half to $1.70 an hour that he's not entitled to $100 guaranteed. I say there's something wrong. But you see, it's the old shell game in America. If you've got too much, they give you some more, but if you haven't got enough, they take it away from you. That's the trouble all over. Now, these salaries and these pensions that the executives in Chrysler get, that wasn't enough. A few months ago, the Chrysler Corporation voted $10.8 million bonus to its executives. So the union bought one share of stock. And we figured we'd send one of our research employees to the Chrysler Board of Directors meeting, their stockholders meeting, to see what we could find out, what was cooking there. So we sent our research director over there with this one share of stock, which gave him the right to sit in the meeting. And one of the Chrysler executives stood before the stockholders meeting and he said, "I make a motion that we divide up $10.8 million in the form of a bonus to the executives." And he said, "All the figures of how much each one gets is sealed in this brown envelope." And the research director for our union, having this one vote behind him, stood up and he said, "Mr. Chairman, I make a motion we open the envelope up and see how much each executive is going to get in a bonus." And they voted that down. They voted to give these fellows a bonus, and the only fellows who knew are the guys who got together and rigged it for themselves. Now, if we were bargaining with Chrysler, if we walked into negotiations tomorrow morning, Norm Matthews and I and Emil Mazie and your committee, and we had our demands in a brown envelope sealed, and we said to Condor, "We want you to give us these demands, but they're all sealed up. We're the only guys that know what they are," he would blow a fuse. But that's the way they do it. And when we ask for reasonable demands, we don't get them. Now let me tell you, brothers and sisters, the Chrysler strike is not an isolated thing. It's a part of a great historic crusade of little people in the world to fight for a larger and fuller measure of economic and social justice. We have gotten nothing on a silver platter. They didn't give us the things to which we were entitled because we were entitled to them. We got them because we fought for them and we sacrificed for them. Look back over the history of mankind's march forward to a happier and brighter day. Free public education, we got it because we fought for it. The 8-hour day we got, seniority, union recognition, all these things they said no to. We had a fight for them. The trouble in America today is that we're getting into trouble economically. There are 4.5 million unemployed. What's the trouble? The great mass of people don't have the money to buy the things we've made. And because we don't have the money to buy the things we make in the factories and the farmers raise on the farms, millions of workers are unemployed. We're not fighting just for economic justice for the wage earners of America. We're fighting to try to get some balance in our economic system between production and purchasing power. Because if we can't balance purchasing power with productive power, we're going to get into trouble in America. This time, just like we did in 1929. The trouble with the Chrysler executives is that they don't know that when we get into serious trouble, there are more millionaires who jump out of the windows of tall buildings than there are workers, because they lose more than we do. They don't know we're fighting to make this thing work on the basis that people can buy back the things they make. I say our cause is just. We're fighting for human decency. We're fighting for human happiness. We're fighting for human dignity. We're fighting for the basic human and democratic values that make life worthwhile. And I say, you've got the support of our union. You've got the support of the whole organized labor movement in America. Just keep your chins up, and let's work together and fight together on this front. I say, before not too long, just as in the past, the Chrysler Corporation will come down out of their ivory tower, and they'll sit down and sign a decent collective bargaining contract with the Chrysler workers, and together, in victory, we'll march into these plants together. Thank you.
Please retain your seats. We have one more speaker, Brother Mazie, on finances. We're not asking you for finances.
For the hardest words in radio. Oh, how much I hate to say these words. But I guess it's all I can do. Our time is up. May I say reluctantly goodbye. May God bless you.
The Messiah Choral Ensemble, composed of members of the UAWCIO and their families, will be heard again next Sunday evening at 7:30. For another recorded half hour of favorite choral works, be with us at this time a week from tonight at 7:30, when we shall again present Elder Jemison and the Messiah Choral Ensemble.
My brother. Thanks a lot.
And there you have part of the proceedings of the fifth day of the 12th UAWCIO convention. You're invited to listen again tomorrow and Saturday as organized labor through this great industrial union, the UAWCIO, speaks.
You've been listening to Guy Nunn with a review of today's activities at the 12th UAW Convention in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Portions of the report were tape recorded. This program is a special events feature of WDET and the UAW CIO Broadcasting Corporation.